For purposes of taking public testimony, I am appointing myself as a subcommittee of the committee. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 157. And who do we have that wants to testify on this besides Kathy? Come on up. So you had to have appreciated that, huh? Who do we have besides Kathy that wants to?
I'll have to fill in.
Okay, you fill in.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Kathy Polino with the Secretary of State Audit Division. I appreciate you hearing this bill. It's Senate Bill 157. Here to testify in support of this bill. Just a little bit of background on this. Current state law already requires agencies to report to us when they sustain a loss of public funds or property, and then we have a responsibility to investigate the losses. There's a couple problems with the way the current law is already stated. It really is unclear as to who this applies to, what actions need to be taken, and kind of some of the timelines for that. And so what this bill does is basically four things. One is it first more clearly defines who the law should apply to. Currently, the law says it applies to any elected or appointed state officer, including members of boards or commissions. There's some confusion out there from agencies as to who a state officer is. And so what we're hoping to do is clarify that this should apply to all public officials defined as a person who is receiving state or is serving as a state agency as an officer, employee, member, agent, or otherwise, regardless of whether the person is compensated for their services. So what this does is some agencies, if an employee, say, steals some money, they don't know if that is qualifies as a public officer, and we want to have that notification come to us when that happens. Second thing it does is it establishes a dollar threshold. Right now, the current law doesn't have any threshold for what needs to go before they need to contact us. And so agencies are a little bit unclear as to whether, you know, if a ream of paper disappears or if $20 is out of the petty cash fund, whether they need to report that to us or not. And so in absence of a threshold, they've been kind of creating their own thresholds in their mind, and some have made it a lot higher than what we would hope to it be to report to us. You know, sometimes like a $200 missing might be just the tip of the iceberg, so we want to make sure that there's a point where they make sure they report to us so we can take a look at it and assess the situation. Third thing it does is it establishes a timeline for reporting. The current law right now doesn't have any timeline as for when an agency discovers a loss until they have to report to us. And we've had some agencies that have taken a lot of time reporting to us, sometimes even over a year before they let us know that there was a loss of funds. You know, they'll handle an internal investigation or handle it as a personnel manner and then let us know about it after the fact. And unfortunately, what happens many times is the records disappear or they get altered or, you know, we want to make sure that the information is maintained properly and with people that are trained to do this. So we want to have some kind of a timeline for when we get reported when the loss occurs. And then the third thing is there's a requirement that we complete an investigation within 30 days. And there are many times when these investigations turn into criminal investigations, and it's not possible at all for us to complete our work within 30 days if it gets tied up in legal matters, or many times we'll need to, just as an example, have bank records sent to us, and sometimes the timelines take longer than 30 days. So what we're hoping to do is to remove that 30-day requirement and say that we need to determine whether an investigation needs to take place within that 30-day period, but remove the requirement that the investigation be completed by 30 days. So that's technically what this bill does. You know, our role when there is a loss of funds, there's many different parties that play roles here. You know, the state police has their investigations and what they do. You know, the local DAs and the Department of Justice has their responsibility. But at the Audits Division, we have really two main responsibilities that nobody else has. One is we're responsible for making sure that the entire loss is identified. Many of the other parties involved only want to have enough information on, you know, so that they can prosecute and not necessarily, they don't need to go back as far as they need to ensure that the whole loss is identified. But the second and probably most important role we play is in figuring out how these losses occurred and what controls broke down to allow that occurrence to take place so that we can get in and make sure that that loss is prevented in the future if possible. So that's our role, and hopefully these couple changes to current law will help strengthen what we do and how we respond to it.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Okay. I do have one question, Kathy. In Section 2, it says ORS 297.120. Does that section of 297 only apply to the Division of Audits? We can look that up. The reason why I'm asking is because in sub 2 it says within 30 days after receiving the report under subsection 1 of the section, Division of Audits is taken out, but it just says the division shall determine whether to investigate the loss. And I'm just wondering if LC did that because of the because understanding that the division is referring back to the Division of Audits that is mentioned in sub 1. I suppose it would be. It's just more of a
grammatical. That's my understanding, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it's a grammatical change.
All right. Just a second. Okay. So it actually is just this little short thing anyway. Yeah, okay. It must be because it refers back to that. Okay, that's fine. Okay. Pardon? Yeah, this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, which we would most likely send it to the House. We would rescind that and send it to the House Budget Committee. I have to ask the Speaker's office if we can lift that. Let's see. And the LFO, Legislative Fiscal Office, says that there is no fiscal impact on Department of Administrative Services, and that there is a minimal, it looks about $73,000 fiscal to the Secretary of State's Audits Division. Oh, okay. Okay. Just a second. Okay, this is kind of a key right here. Okay, so what we can do, we have a basis here, I think, for sending, for requesting to the Speaker that we rescind the referral to Ways and Means and just send it to the floor. But I have to do that by letter. So I won't open a work session on this today. What we will do, though, schedule it for a work session on Tuesday, and then and between now and then we'll send a letter up. I'll send a letter up to Speaker's office requesting.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum. Yes.
Thanks a lot, Kathy. I missed the first part of your testimony, so you probably addressed this. But the absence of a dollar threshold, right now, I see in your written testimony, you say that agencies sort of establish their own threshold. Is it usually higher than $100 in most cases, or do you anticipate that this would call for more audits than you're currently doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, there's some agencies report every little thing that they've, I use the example of a ream of paper, and it doesn't get that small, but, we have had reports of $10 was missing from the petty cash fund, so they let us know. But what we're looking for is something that makes it a reasonable reporting amount, because without that dollar amount, we actually don't know what we don't know, and that's the part that we're worried about. We have found some cases where agencies have on, some of the bigger dollar amounts, $500, $600, which might even be just the tip of the iceberg of what the actual loss was, has decided that's not big enough to report. And so what we're hoping to do with having a number, and we're not wed to $100, but we thought that would be a good number so it was big enough that we're not getting the pieces of paper and, the small things that are lost, but not too large so that you know, for example, we had one that was, I think, about a $200 missing, but then when we started to look into it, it ended up being something that was taken over a number of years, and it was more than $200. So what we're hoping to do with that is find a good medium place. So we don't know what we don't know.
Follow up. So, but it's possible that the number of investigations could end up being the same, but just that they would be consistent, that they would report to you at the same dollar amount, and you wouldn't have to deal with the little petty things.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, a lot of times, too, these are handled just with, we don't launch full investigations on these. If the agency discovers a loss, let's say they have an internal auditor that's looking into it, and they're going to report back to us on what they find when they get done, and it's a localized kind of thing, we may not do anything except for, you know, wait to receive a report and follow up on that at a later date. So, you know, many times these kinds of things kind of take care of themselves, but there are unfortunately those times where we do need to go in and do additional work. And I don't think this bill in particular would change the amount of work that we end up doing. Mm-hmm.
I think the important thing here is that is the notification. So even as Kathy was saying, even if there's an internal auditor that's already working on it, but the notification to the Secretary of State's office so that they're aware, and then if they need to do additional, or if they're going to need to do some work on it, she can start figuring out how she's going to resource it.
So just a comment, Mr. Chair, it doesn't seem like this bill really does have a fiscal impact. I don't know why it would need to go to Ways and Means.
And I don't know either why it was why it had a subsequent referral. So that's why I'm going to ask for, and you and I can't move it anyway.
Right.
And so so rather than take it to work session today, we'll just post it for a work session on Tuesday.
Sure.
And we'll write a letter to the speaker's office today asking for permission to rescind the referral. Okay?
Great.
And then, so,
thank you.
That's what we'll do. Okay? Anybody else want to talk on Senate Bill 157? Okay, thank you. Then, thank you, Kathy. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 157. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 405A. And,
we have a quorum. Yeah, even though I have a quorum now, I'm going to go ahead and wait because I don't need to go to the speaker's office here to take it with me.
So we'll just go through the steps that they requested that we go through, which is good. Okay, we have opened the public hearing on Senate Bill 405A. We have Brett Benatta and Greg Jeffrey with us. Great. Did I say that right, Jeffrey? You guys aren't together. Oh, okay. Oh, actually, okay, let's have you come up, and then I apologize. Greg, we'll have you come up in a few moments. Oh, I see. Fred Van Atta and...
I am Fred Van Atta, appearing before you on half of the Oregon Board of Optometry, the Oregon Board of Architects, Examiners, the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists, and the Oregon Landscape Contractors Board, all of which are semi-independent agencies. This bill will be familiar to some of you as Representative Butler sponsored a similar bill in last session. That was before the General Government Committee and subsequently passed the House, but ran into difficulties. A version also passed the Senate, but things never quite got reconciled in the final days of the session. Simply, it allows the semi-independent agencies to borrow money to buy real property. When the semi-independent agency statute was originally passed creating the agencies, they allowed the semi-independent agencies to own real property and to encumber real property. That's in the existing statute. But when one of the agencies went to the Attorney General's office and said, we want to borrow money to buy real property, they said, the statute does not allow you to borrow money to buy the property. It's a very technical reading of the statute, and so our purpose is to expressly allow to change the statute to expressly allow the agencies to enter into loan agreements for buying real property. And this, the Attorney General's office and the State Treasurer's office have gone over the language very carefully, and it very precisely points out that this doesn't constitute a debt or a liability to any other state agency or state official or state fund, that any indebtedness the semi-independent agency incurs has to be repaid by the semi-independent agency, and nobody else has any other liability. The Department of Administrative Services expressed some concern about, because they are generally responsible for state government's activities in the acquisition of real property, expressed some concern about this when the bill was this time and was in the Senate. And there is language in Section 2, subsection 2, and Mr. Jeffries will presumably address that issue, but there is the requirement that any loan agreement to purchase real property be submitted to the Department of Administrative Services for them to review and to give their advice to the board before the board actually signs the contract. In other words, the Department of Administrative Services has an opportunity to review it and give their advice to the give their advice to the board before they take final action on the loan agreement. We believe this keeps these independent boards, and there are our agencies, and there are 10 of them currently in the state, from being sentenced to be tenants for the rest of eternity. They will have it. They will have a chance to acquire permanent office space and generate for their members the savings that comes from ownership. So it's good economic sense for the agencies, and will be helpful to the professional and other people that are licensed and pay the costs of the agencies. And maybe Mr. Plunkett, who has been a pioneer in the whole independent, semi-independent agency concept, and has followed the legislation through and is sort of the father of this legislation. I will turn the podium to him to talk a little bit about it from his view, and he can answer any questions that you might have about how, why there are semi-independent agencies, how they function.
Thank you.
My name is David Plunkett, Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Optometry. Sheriff Carmel, members of the committee. This bill really is trying to clarify, as Fred said, what occurred in 1997 when semi-independent boards were started, and again in 99, in which everyone thought at the time that the boards had the ability to own their own property. They could have their own home and pass those savings on. And only to find out later from the Department of Justice that we can in fact own property, we just can't finance it. So being agencies that don't have a lot of cash laying around, that's really not a possibility for us. For small boards, when you're looking at expenses, the first thing, the major expenses for a board is personnel costs. When you get beyond that, you're looking at two other things: attorney general cost and the cost of your office space, so your leasing operations. Those are the major costs. So if you're looking to save money, which we always are, the obvious thing that you can control the most is the cost of your housing. And that's what this would allow us to do. Because you figure even if, in borrowing money, you end up paying as much in a mortgage payment as you would currently on a lease, leases continue to go up, and that amount would be fixed, and so those savings generate every month from then on. And, of course, eventually you will have it paid for, and you have nothing but maintenance from that building. So there's a huge amount of money that can be saved over the course of years with us being able to have our own home. One of the things I think is important that as indicated in Section 2, that any obligation incurred by a board is payable solely from the revenues of the board or from pledged assets owned and operated by the board. There is no liability to Oregon taxpayers or the state's general fund under any of the provisions of this bill. So I think that, and generally what happens if they're on commercial property is, you know, the asset is pledged, so even if there were something go wrong, the asset serves and usually makes the lender whole. They're happy to get it back, in other words. So looking at the worst case scenario. But we think this bill makes a lot of sense and would urge you to pass it out. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Crummell, members of the committee. My name is Carol Halford. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Board of Architect Examiners, and we're one of the semi-independent agencies that would be affected by this bill. The board obviously has done the cost measures and determined that this is a good bill. Being able to finance its own real office space would be an advantage and a cost savings to the agency as a whole. And the Architect Board has been in existence since 1918 and probably will be around for the foreseeable future, and we're one of the agencies that are looking pretty hard to be able to take advantage of this bill. So the Architect Board is asking for your support.
Thank you. Are there questions for any of our witnesses?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder?
Thank you. And I don't know who to address this to, but whoever wants to answer, just jump right in. But I serve on several boards for nonprofit organizations, and one of the questions I had was about just clarification of the liability, if there's a default on the loan, if you're not able to pay it, and who would be responsible? I mean, would that be the members of the... You know, the board, is that, I mean, we're saying there's no liability on general fund, so who would be responsible? I know as a nonprofit board of board members, we are responsible, and we also have, most nonprofits have liability insurance, so that was a question I had.
If I may, Fred Bonata, I think if you look at on page 1, line 9, is payable solely from revenues of the board or from pledged assets owned by the board. And whoever lends the money is kind of bound by that provision of the statute. And if the board, for some reason, doesn't have revenues to pay it, why, it doesn't get paid. And both the state treasurer's office and the attorney general's office has gone over that language pretty clearly because they don't care to have, you know, they do not want to be in the position of having the board, you know, commit the state general fund to any liability. Unless there was fraud or deceit, why I think that's pretty clear that liability does not pass to the board members.
a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up, Revenue Dinkle.
I saw that in the language. I guess if the revenues aren't there, I mean, for some reason, it's probably going to be a unique situation. But, you know, having served on a board that got into debt and having to deal with that, I mean, it happens. And so I guess what would be of interest to me, and this was in, Mr. Plunkett, in your testimony, the last line, the second to last line says there's no liability to Oregon's taxpayers or the general fund under the provisions of this bill. And then the last line says a review by alleged counsel and attorney general's office tend to concur. One question is, what does that mean? Do they concur or not? And do you have opinions? And that's something that would be helpful, is to see in writing the opinion from either alleged counsel or the attorney general's office.
Chair Cromwell, Representative Dingfield. Yes, we did have information from both the Attorney General's office about that, and that was the previous session, in last session's bill, and legislative. And we do have a copy of that, and I can probably get that for you.
Okay.
And of course, legislative council also reviewed this, as did the attorney general's office again this year. Matter of fact, they helped draft the language.
Okay. But, Mr. Chair, it would be helpful just to get copies of that.
That would be fine, David. If you can provide that to us, that would be good.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In that aspect, this borrowing becomes much like certificates of participation. It's based upon your members' assessment is what it is. As long as the members that you're working with continue to work with you and pay their fees and dues, as long as we've got, I guess, a board of optometry, that assures us that there would be that resource available. And as was mentioned in earlier testimony by Mr. Van Hatta, I have worked on this particular issue from time to time over the last two sessions, have seen those legal opinions, or the legal opinion and the information, and am convinced that this does not bind the state of Oregon. It basically, anybody who, and there is a fee for that, anybody who buys those bonds will be buying or loaning that money, will be buying the bond or loaning the money, I guess it's one way or the other, on the basis of the good faith and credit of the fact that there are going to be optometrists in the state of Oregon. And if not, then all they can come back to is the underlying asset, the real property. And of course, that's not necessarily all bad.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fred or anyone else, as a practical matter right now, are these semi-independent agencies not at all able to arrange financing or purchase property then? Is that the need for this bill?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Rosenbaum, yes, that is the need for the bill. We are not able to do it because we've tried to do it, and Department of Justice has blocked us because they said, in reading the bill, it doesn't say what you think it says. Mm-hmm. And we always thought, and I go back to 97 when this semi-independent statute was drafted and passed, and I'm sure that the members at the time, having been involved in that, thought, and because it was said to us, you need to be able to buy your own building to save cost. So I think everyone thought that was the case until we actually tried to do it, and then we hit a stumbling block. So, yes, we've been working on this actually for several years, mm-hmm. and this is the roadblock.
If I may, Fred Bonatta, if you want to see the original language, look on page 2, line 7. Notwithstanding ORS chapter 279, the boards may enter into contracts and acquire, hold, own, encumber, issue, replace, deal in, and with, and dispose of real and personal property. That was the original statute. And only a lawyer could be fooled by that into believing that you couldn't borrow money to buy real property, but lawyers said that didn't allow you to borrow money to buy real property. If you owned it, you could encumber it, but if you don't own it, apparently you can't encumber it. So this is a clarification.
Okay, follow-up, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know we're going to be hearing from Department of Administrative Services about their role in all this, but what is the legislature's role? Does, I assume since your budget has to go before the Ways and Means Committee, would these arrangements also require approval from Ways and Means or from the Emergency Board as part of your budget process?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Rosenbaum. No, our budgets do not go before Ways and Means.
Oh, they don't?
No.
Oh.
They're set through the administrative rule process. We have public hearings. We notify all of our licensees about, in fact, we're doing that right now. The fact that we're going to, what our budget's going to be, give them copies of it, ask for comments and input, and so that's the way the budgets are set. The legislature's input is, well, we had a bill in this committee just a little bit earlier this session, House Bill 2029, which changed some of the reporting requirements for these boards. And there are lots of mechanisms in there for review of what semi-independent agencies do, and we feel that's quite sufficient. If you want to look at it, there's checks and balances there.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? I have a couple of questions. What happens, I guess, first of all, if NASS says this is a bad deal? Can the board just go ahead and do it anyway, or
the what? Way that I believe the answer to that probably is yes. But think about the people that are appointed to these boards. They are successful professionals in their profession. They're selected by the governor. They're approved by the Senate. They are appointed to the board. Most of them, at that stage of their professional life, have dealt in real property, either their home or their professional office. And if the Department of Administrative Services comes in and says, "You guys have made a bad deal here," they're not going to go forward with it. It just, but DAS does not have veto power over it.
Okay. Could you lease to other agencies? So, for example, if Board of Optometry said, "Gosh, we got this just a great deal on this building, and there's enough space in here that we could turn around and lease space to, the Board of Architects and the Board of Landscape Contractors and the Board of, whatever other boards are out there that are semi-independent agencies." We could basically have our mortgage paid for us by other lessors. Or we could lease it, doesn't have to be a state agency. We could lease it to, Fred Van Atta and Company or Tom Butler Esquire CPA. I guess they're not Esquire. How would that be?
Mr. Chairman, Fred Venata, I would call your attention to the language on page 2, line 8, 9, and 10. It says the boards may deal in and with real property and with real and personal property of any nature in the board's own name, including but not limited to purchasing, leasing, managing, operating, and disposing of the property. So the answer is yes. They can buy it, and if they want to lease a piece of it to somebody, they have the authority to do that.
Representative Crummell, may I comment on it?
Yes, please.
And the answer, of course, is yes. And I should point out that the semi-independent boards work very closely together, and we were working on a project in which several of us would have been located in one building because we're always looking for ways to save money and to enhance our operations. And so, yes, that would happen, and probably would happen that there would be more than one board in a building. Yes.
Fred Bonatta, the point is you've got 3 to 5 employees. These are small entities.
Sure.
And they can have common copy machines and common boardrooms and common receptionists. They can save a lot of money by bringing several of them together in the same place and use the same physical facility, it would make absolute sense to the professionals that finance these boards to look at that opportunity to share costs.
What would happen if, and I appreciate that, and the ability of the boards then to consolidate and to have their own operations but consolidate into one place and save money, but what would happen then, if you had a building and you had a sign up and, I showed up, said, gee, I'd like to put my business in here, and we signed a deal. What would happen in terms of tax issues if you turned around at least, 1,000 square feet to Jerry Crummell Enterprises? I mean, I don't have Jerry Crummell Enterprises, it's just made up, but as an example.
A for-profit.
And it's a for-profit hopefully it's a for-profit operation.
So make that clarification, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, yes, you get enough clients in there and it's a for-profit operation. It's intended to be a for-profit. What happens in terms of property tax issues? What happens in terms of income tax issues for both the lessee and the leasor? How does that work? And maybe that's stuff that we don't need to get to, minutiae that we don't need to get involved with here, but I'm just curious as to what happens.
Chair Cromo, it's minor, and Representative Butler probably knows the answer, but it's my understanding that space then would be taxable space. Not the whole space, but the portion of it that was rented to a non-semi-independent agency or a non-governmental agency would be taxable.
So then you would have to figure out what proportion of it is of the building it is, and then that portion of it would be prorated on your property.
Mr. Chair, again, having worked on this in prior sessions and have had the conversations with Department of Justice and the Department of Revenue and those other folks, originally the desire was to bring two or three agencies together in the same building, they'd buy the building, and I think they picked out the property and were ready to go on it before they got kicked in the shins, because it doesn't say exactly you can do this or you shall do that. It says you may do some of these things, and the lawyer said, well, we can't do that. So if at a later time you had two boards using up 4,000 square feet in a building, and the second board said, or both boards came to an agreement and said, you know what, we both needed a little bit more space and we can't put it in here, so those boards then went ahead and disposed of between themselves, and the second board bought another building of its own 4,000 square foot, and then you had the current board would expand from 2,000 to 2,500 feet, leaving 1,500 feet to be leased out to a third party. That's 37.5%. What happens is that you come in, your assessor actually comes in and says, if that's leased out to a for-profit entity, then 37.5% of that building comes back onto the tax rolls for the time that it's leased out to a taxpaying or to a for-profit entity. They rent it out to an insurance or a real estate office or to some other taxpaying organization or for-profit organization. It comes back on the tax rolls. Now, I think there are rules and regulations in statute that says that you can't go out and do this in competition and make profits. That's not what they were after, was to make profits off of it. But as long as it's covering the cost of maintaining the building, cost of operating the property, then at that particular point there is no net profit that's a taxable profit to the board. The board still maintains its non-profit status, a tax-exempt status. I think 167 is the code or in the revised statute code section that you continue as a, no, it isn't 167. Anyway, that's an Internal Revenue Code. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. At any rate, they would still maintain their municipal status as a municipal organization, but that portion of the building, while they are in the process of expanding to take it over with the rest of the organization, but leasing it to a for-profit would come on the tax rolls.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. Now, the other thing, the other question I have is relative to maintenance. Generally speaking, do you anticipate, David, that if you guys bought a building, that you would utilize the same kind of
standards, for example, that the Department of Administrative Services utilizes, from, you know, so that you've got, I'm sure your lender's going to make sure that you've got the correct ratio in terms of the amount of money coming in versus going out for a mortgage. But then making sure that you have reserves for maintenance and operations and those sorts of things, so that you don't have the type of thing that has happened with the ODOT building, where basically the department has let the building fall into a shambles, and now they want DAS to come in and bail them out and buy the building from them, and then, you know, and see if other state agencies will sort of pick up the slack and pay for their own maintenance mistakes.
Representative Cromwell, members of the committee, yes, we're very aware of that. There will be reserves set aside for maintenance. And, you know, if you look at our board, their board has been around since 1915. Our board is 1905. This is our 100th year this year.
Oh, wow.
All of our members are professionals. Most of them own their own business. They're small business people. And, you know, they expect certain things. They haven't been able to understand why we hadn't been able to do this. And so they are business people, is what I'm trying to say, and they understand these things as well as we do. So, yeah.
Okay, I just, you know, deferred maintenance. Government deferred maintenance has been, that has happened since the mid-1970s, has turned out to be the biggest error, the biggest mistake, and the biggest boondoggle that could have ever occurred. And quite frankly, as a legislature, you know, 30 years ago, we should have said, nope, there's not going to be any of that. If you can't afford to keep it up, then you need to get rid of it.
And we were
because now, you know, it's time to pay the piper, and nobody's and everybody's complaining they still don't have the money for it. So I just, you know, put that out there as a cautionary note. I don't mean to sound like I'm trying to lecture you from the dais. You guys are smart people, and you know what you're doing. But I just want to make sure that, you know, deferred maintenance is no longer an acceptable way to go.
Mr. Chair, you and I are in business in one form or another, and we set aside prudent reserves for those kinds of things. I think that's what David and Mr. Van Hatter are telling us, is that they're prudent business people, and they'll set aside those things. They're not going to run it into the ground and expect somebody to bail them out. Because they are semi-independent organizations, there isn't anybody to bail them out.
Mm-hmm. So that's very true. Very true. Are there any other questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Jeffrey.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Greg Jeffrey. I'm the finance manager with the Budget Management Division of Department of Administrative Services. Department of Administrative Services opposes passage of Senate Bill 405. The bill allows the semi-independent boards to enter into real estate deals without the normal procurement and review processes that are in place for all other state agencies. It also allows the boards to enter into financing agreements without the approval of the Department of Administrative Services and the state treasurer, again, which is also required for all other state agencies. These procedures serve to assist not only state agencies, but also the best interests of the state. The semi-independent boards were set up as regulatory bodies. Building and property ownership is not a part of their mission. Boards would not necessarily be staffed with professionals trained in real estate transactions and finance. Mr. Van Atta had noted, you know, that the original bill was amended, you know, to include a review process by DAS, but that process is limited to the loan agreement or financing agreement element of a real estate transaction, and as we noted, it's really an advisory role, you know, that the Department of Administrative Services would play. So for these reasons, the Department of Administrative Services is opposed to these provisions of the bill. Any questions you might have?
Okay. Representative Butler?
A couple of questions for Greg, Mr. Chair. Chair, or the Greg, when we say that by removing the by removing the Department of Administrative Services and relegating them to an advisory role only at that particular point where you don't have the veto power, is there any indication that they won't take your advice or listen to your counsel advice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we haven't really discussed, you know, I haven't discussed that with them. So I really can't, anticipate, you know, how they would react, you know, to...
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Butler.
Thank you. Greg, so with regard to the advisory role, what was the relationship between ODOT with its building here on the campus in relationship to DAS and how they got themselves into the problem they got themselves in? Was that an advisory role and that went sour?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, ODOT, the state of Oregon, when it comes to the building ownership, has a very different arrangement depending on, I think, the history and the funding sources for different agencies. So, for instance, the Department of Administrative Services, they own a number of square footage, and that's managed within the Uniform Rent Program. But then other agencies are the sole owner, and the sole responsible agency for their particular building, like the Department of Transportation. Really, DAS over that particular building, you know, and the same is true for the DVA building and some other buildings that are located within Salem. And again, those facilities are the direct responsibility of the Department of Transportation in the instance you're noting, and not the responsibility of DAS.
So if I could follow up on that. And so tell me what happened it was pretty evident as we are around these buildings that are being that DAS has some advisory responsibility for, or at least has some control over on the Capitol Mall. Where did we fall short there? I mean, if DAS is the ultimate purveyor of wisdom and knowledge relative to how these buildings should be maintained and to counsel with these agencies, why wasn't it being done?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, there have been, it has been recognized in the past, you know, that there is an ongoing, you know, for every building that exists, there's an ongoing potential for deterioration unless there are, you know, regular maintenance routines, you know, that are followed. I think the DHS, you know, mental health campus, you know, is another excellent example of that. Those have been identified. DAS has worked with them in the past. Even as I remember, about 3 or 4 or 5 sessions ago, there was a provision allowing agencies to set up, you know, a maintenance, you know, fund by building, you know, that into, you know, what, you know, what they would charge, you know, their various divisions or their programs. The bottom line gets to be, though, they simply didn't get the budget dollars granted to them to fund those, you know, particular operations. I think, again, I'm not a building maintenance specialist, but I think that...
Mr. Chair, I think Greg has just made my point. DAS is not building specialist maintenance specialist. I mean, DAS may have some awfully good people within the organization, but while you are here in charge of the buildings on the campus, on the Capitol Mall, and allowing buildings to deteriorate before your very eyes, then when we come back and say we'd like to have another set of eyes on this as advisory only and not veto power, I mean, Greg, I think you're making my point for me. Even though I'd like to hold it just to the ODOT building and some of the other buildings that DAS ultimately has some responsibility for making certain that the money is set aside for, to make certain that that the agency is aware that the building is falling out around their ears and that somebody's going to have to pick up the tab at some particular point. I think if that's the responsibility of DAS, you failed woefully in the physical facilities portion of it. So if you're coming to us and saying we object to this because we are the ultimate wizards as to maintenance of buildings, then I think that, that's probably the best reason for us to ignore the opposition of DAS. Now, I've got another question for you, Greg, and that is when you read paragraphs, well, on page 2, down lines 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, and same thing down on lines 35, 36, 37, down there. What do you think that it means when statutes say that this board may enter into contracts, acquire, hold, own, encumber, issue, replace, deal in, and dispose of real property and personal property? What does that mean to you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I believe that it indicates that it is giving them the authority to participate in those transactions.
So they've had that authority in the past. Did DAS come forward and object to that in the past?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, again, my role in the Department of Administrative Services is in the area of finance management. Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
In answer to your question.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions?
He asked them for me.
Okay. Okay. I don't think I have any either. I understand. I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, now my understanding from our administrator is that we have submitted a letter to let me back up. I won't close the public hearing yet. We have submitted a letter to the Speaker's office, and for all intents and purposes, it has been approved to remove the subsequent referrals of Ways and Means on this and send this bill directly to the floor. So with that, then what I'm going to do is that I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 405, and I would entertain a motion to Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 405A, as previously engrossed A version, be moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
And the subsequent referral to Ways and Means
and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded by previous discussion with the leadership.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 405A passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Discussion. Is there any are there any objections? And sort of call the roll.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative
Greenfelder?
Aye.
Mr. Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Mr. Butler?
Aye. Senate Bill 405A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Butler, would you carry this?
You're delighted to.
Thank you very much. Representative Butler will be the carrier, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 405. Members, on Tuesday, at this particular point, it's going to be a very brief meeting. We'll bring Senate Bill 457 back for a work session. Excuse me, 157. Thank you for correcting me. And we may have some other issues that we are dealing with DAS. I would really like to get started on time because I think as our floor sessions, we're going to probably be starting to get start earlier on floor sessions, and I want to make sure that we have the time that we have necessary. And the other thing is that if we don't have a long agenda, we can just get done earlier.
Oh, yeah.
So with that, we'll stand adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Last session. Well, they had a chance to reconsider
the partners'
conference.
Yeah. And they told us.
Thank you, sir.